This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. At the recent World Swimming Championships in Montreal, the Chinese athletes won only 5 medals, none of them gold. For an ambitious team that will be competing at home in the next Summer Olympics, that would seem to be a major disappointment. But John Leonard, the head of the American Swimming Coaches Association, has postulated that China's apparently lackluster performance may be part of an ambitious and frankly ominous plan. In a paper entitled Fears and Facts, Mr. Leonard has suggested that China has kept as many as 50 of the country's top swimmers away from international competition so that the athletes could not be tested for performance-enhancing drugs and so that they would be able to take advantage of various illegal substances and procedures in virtual seclusion until shortly before the 2008 Games. Chinese officials in Montreal for the World Championships denied that they are conducting secret training programs. Those authorities acknowledged that in the past, their swimming programs were riddled with drugs. How could they do otherwise? During the 90s, 32 Chinese swimmers were caught using steroids or other banned substances, which brings to mind a question. Wouldn't it be exceptionally dumb for the Chinese to cheat again and risk getting caught again in their own backyard?
Indeed, it would.
Craig Lord is the swimming correspondent for the Times of London.
And that is an extraordinary thing, but I have to say, when we sat in Perth, Australia, in 98, and the news came through that enough human growth hormone had been found in the bags of one Chinese swimmer to sustain the whole of the team during their stay in Perth, you know, you're left open-mouthed by the stupidity of it. So just because you think, my God, how do they think they could possibly get away with it and how stupid would that be, doesn't mean to say that someone's not doing it. Now, in most of our countries, it's the one-off person, the one-off cheat who's doing it individually. It's not driven by a state. It's driven by a coach and a swimmer or a coach and an athlete. This is systematic. That's the difference, that somehow, somewhere, someone is abusing children. And that is the serious nature of this allegation, is that you have a whole generation potentially being abused.
The cheating scandals involving Chinese swimmers in the past and Beijing's brave prediction that its swimmers will prevail at the 2008 Games are not the only reasons suspicions about the program have arisen. Helga Pfeiffer, who worked with East Germany's athletes in a program driven by steroids during the 70s and 80s, has been a consultant to the Chinese program, though she says she has merely been selling training equipment. John Leonard is skeptical.
Well, she also denied that she ever had anything to do with performance-enhancing drugs until they had it caught in writing in the Stasi papers. So, I appreciate Helga's ability and insistence on her cleanliness in this matter, but the fact is she's one of the most feared doping people in the world because of what she knows about how to do it.
Another reason for suspicion is that in the past, some of China's most accomplished and most promising swimmers have dropped from the international swimming scene. Did they fail preliminary drug tests at home? Did experimental training programs make them ill? Craig Lord says it's hard to know.
In China, in a system that has a centralized control and so on, if this child is in the system, is in a sports school, he will be somewhere. Someone will know what happened to him. But when questions are put to Chinese about this, they say they have no idea. They don't know where he is. And it's the same answer you get for people like Dai Guohong was a world champion in 94. She came, she conquered, and she disappeared. And no one can tell you where she is now. And again, the suggestion is that she was very ill. Now, you can't back up these allegations unless you know, but, you know, it is up to China, like everybody else, to answer the questions.
At the World Championships in Montreal earlier this summer, Chinese coaches maintained that their program is open for inspection and reminded the press that China had even invited a team from Australia to participate in China's national championships. Amy Shipley, who covers swimming for the Washington Post, was among the reporters who spoke to the Chinese coaches. I asked her if the program in China was today open or if much of it was, as John Leonard suggests, still operating secretly.
Well, I think they are open to an extent. They are inviting people into the country. I know they are accommodating journalists. I haven't gone over there yet, but they are making accommodations for journalists who want to see their sports programs. As the coach pointed out to me over the weekend, they even invited some Australian swimmers to take part in their national championships last year. What the problem is, while it does indeed appear things are open, there's the question, are they really open? Are we seeing everything? And, you know, it's because of China's terrible reputation in the arena of drugs that reputation has really followed China unfairly or otherwise, and there's going to be a lot of suspicion leading up to the games.
The Chinese authorities maintain that they test their swimmers, but can FINA, swimming's world governing body, and WADA, the World Anti-Doping Agency, test Chinese athletes who remain in China rather than compete at the World Championships or in other international events?
They certainly can, and they certainly do. The problem that people raise, and it's not a problem, it's the suspicion that is raised, is that there are all these athletes in China who were plucked out of, China schools maybe 3 or 4 years ago, have never competed internationally, have no international standing, and therefore are not being sought out for drug tests. You know, the idea is that if you want to, you can hide people by developing them without exposing them to world competitions. That's true. That certainly doesn't mean they're doing it. And the real problem with this type of suspicion with nothing behind it, with no substantiation, is that you could do this with any country. Look at the United States. At the 2002 Salt Lake Olympics, the United States won 34 medals. The previous U.S. best in a Winter Games was 13 medals. Why did, Americans not react with outrage to that, saying, well, surely, our own team must have been doping? You really, really have to be careful with this type of speculation. John Leonard believes what someone told him, and that's his point of view, but certainly as a journalist, I have seen no evidence of this type of activity, and I'm certainly curious about it, but it's very dangerous to draw conclusions.
As you recently reported in the Washington Post, no Chinese swimmers tested positive for banned substances in 2004, although three U.S. swimmers did. Given that statistic, what is to prevent people from disregarding the concerns of John Leonard and Dave Salo as bad sportsmanship and perhaps paranoid bad sportsmanship at that?
Well, it's a real danger. Whenever Americans say anything, as it is, Americans have a terrible reputation. There's this feeling around the world that we are very sanctimonious about issues such as drug testing, when in fact, we are the home of the Bauko scandal. We have more athletes who routinely exceed expectations and therefore could raise eyebrows as far as drugs go. So when we start making these accusations, I think internationally that is not very well received.
Amy Shipley is a staff writer for The Washington Post. She spoke to me from Miami. Amy, thank you very much.
No problem. Thank you.
Just days before they were to open preseason camp, the Arizona Cardinals moved that camp from Flagstaff to Prescott due to a stomach virus outbreak on the Northern Arizona University campus. The Woeful Cards hope the change of scenery will be emblematic of a bigger change for the team and for their perennially disappointed fans. For the first time in years, football observers say the Cardinals could be a contender. Arizona Public Radio's Mitch Teich reports.
It's been a long time since the Arizona Cardinals finished first in anything except alphabetical order. Yet in the 2005 NFL landscape, many are picking the Cardinals to challenge for a division title. That's partly because the NFC West is considered especially weak this year, but it's also because the Cardinals' lineup has gone through a radical overhaul since Dennis Green was hired as head coach before last season. Green led the Cards to just a 6-10 record last year, but he says he knows the bar for this year's team is much higher.
I know what Bill Bidwell had when he brought me in here, and he didn't bring me in here and say I brought a guy that's won a lot of games, but we don't expect to win a lot of games here. That would never happen. I got a guy here that won a lot of games, and I expect him to win a lot of games here.
And Green might just have the tools with which to win a lot of games. The team locked up wide receiver Anquan Boldin with a 4-year contract extension. Boldin missed 6 games last year and still came within 2 catches of leading the team. And big things are expected of running back J.J. Arrington, who rushed for more than 2,000 yards last year at the University of California. Arrington and the other Cardinals backs will be taking handoffs this year from Super Bowl veteran and 2-time League Most Valuable Player Kurt Warner. Warner, who's coming off 2 down seasons, is hoping to revive his career in the desert. Whether he can do that depends in part on an offensive line that's taken some licks from opponents and the media in recent years. One of the few holdovers is tackle Fred Wakefield, who also likes what he sees this year.
We got some guys who can play, we got some guys who want to work, and you know, it seems like everything's meshing together well.
But with 16 years in Arizona and all of one playoff win to show for it, Cardinals fans have learned not to get their hopes too high. And the jury is still out about this year's edition, especially whether Kurt Warner is the right guy to represent the team's future. Steve Santelli, one of about 120 fans at Tuesday's practice session, is a believer.
I think that they're going to improve this year. I really do. I'm looking forward to having a good season.
What in particular excites you about this team?
Kurt Warner. You know, he did it for me with the Rams. He's going to do it for me here, too.
Todd Guest thinks the Cardinals could win the division, but he's not sure Kurt Warner is the guy who will deliver the title.
I'm still holding judgment on Kurt Warner. I'm not really sure. I mean, two-time MVP, he's second highest-rated passer. He's got a lot of issues in the past couple of years, so we'll see how he does.
But Guess and Santelli agree that the quarterback issue won't really matter if no one shows up to watch the team again this year. The Cardinals drew around 37,000 fans a game at Sun Devil Stadium last year, 13,000 fewer than the next-to-last team in attendance, and about two-thirds of what the Arizona State Sun Devils draw in the very same stadium. Head coach Dennis Green boldly predicts the team's play will take care of the attendance issues.
You know what? I think winning takes it. I never worry about the seats because Americans always want to see winners play, plain and simple. So if we're playing winning football, people will come see us play. So that's really the key.
Green, though, has stopped short of promising the team will make the playoffs. He says the 2005 Cardinals should go a long way towards finally building some excitement over professional football in Arizona. It's an excitement that's already buzzing among his players, including running back J.R. Redmond.
What I can say is I like what I'm seeing here, and it's a start. It's a good start.
Redmond and the rest of the Cardinals say the time to win is now. They'll move into a new stadium next season, and it would help if they brought some fans with them. For Only a Game, I'm Mitch Tyke at the Cardinals training camp in Prescott, Arizona.
It's 19. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, Dragon Tykes put their tiny pedals to the metal. But first, the 7th Gay Games will take place next July in Chicago. The Gay Games have not only been the premier sporting competition for gay and lesbian athletes since the 80s, organizers also claim that in terms of participation, they now constitute the world's largest athletic event. But that may soon change. About 1 year from now, only 2 weeks after the end of the Gay Games, the torch will be extinguished at the first annual World Out Games in Montreal. Only a Game's Karen Given reports on the competing competitions.
Covered in sweat, his fair skin flushed from exertion, Jed Thompson runs down the field at the Boston Strikers' weekly practice in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Thompson actually lives in Rhode Island, but he commutes the hour or so every Sunday to play soccer and volleyball in Boston's gay leagues.
It's a great way to meet other guys without going to a club or a bar, so it's a lot of fun, actually.
Thompson is relatively new to the gay sports scene, but even he has heard of the Gay Games, the premier lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender sporting event since 1982.
I found out last year that they're going to be on this continent, and I was thrilled. And I actually just found out about the Out Games, and I'm thrilled, actually, because that's even better. It's still sort of like a two for one.
But not everyone sees the emergence of the Out Games as a boon for gay sports. Jim Buzinski is CEO of Outsports.com, a website for gay sports fans and athletes.
I think it shows just great dysfunction. Why I think that it's possible to have two sports events, the fact that they're occurring within 2 weeks of each other, it kind of shows a dysfunction. I would think that both is kind of hoping the other kind of fails. I mean, this is a lot of bad blood, which I think is understandable, but it's kind of embarrassing.
It's not a coincidence that the two events are so similar. The first World Out Games were originally planned as the 7th World Gay Games. After being selected as the host city over Chicago, Atlanta, and L.A., Montreal organizers spent the next 2 years securing millions of dollars in support from federal, provincial, and city governments, lining up corporate sponsors and a television deal. But they hadn't yet signed a contract with the Federation of Gay Games.
The Montreal people thought the contract was too restrictive to them. The Federation thought Montreal was basically stalling and trying to get as much information on how to put together a sporting event so they could, in turn, do their own sporting event. I mean, there was an enormous level of mistrust almost from the start.
Both sides agreed that the Gay Games business model needed to be changed. The last three events, held in New York, Amsterdam, and Sydney, ran budget deficits, with Sydney losing more than $1 million. The last two events were nearly canceled. Roberto Montacci is the co-president of the Federation of Gay Games.
There was always a different reason for their deficit, but after the Gay Games of Sydney, the Federation of Gay Games felt that we really had to do something to stop this pattern.
The Federation wanted a smaller, more manageable event with a focus on sport. Montreal's business plan called for 24,000 participants, 35 official sports, and a huge cultural conference. As the deadline for signing the contract approached, Montreal organizers declared they had come too far to quit, and that if the Federation of Gay Games didn't agree to a contract, Montreal would hold an event of their own. In November of 2003, the two sides parted ways, and in early 2004, the 2006 Gay Games were awarded to Chicago. Montacci says the differences between the groups were simply too great.
We are all representatives from the community, from sport teams. And we were negotiating in the end with mostly representatives of the Tourism Board of Montreal and people who are either non-LGBT or LGBT, but with no history and knowledge of the tradition of this movement. So I think that was the shift. We were talking with people that don't share the same values that we do.
In our opinion, by rejecting the Montreal project, they rejected a new version of being open-minded to mainstream life.
The Gay Games are open to everyone, regardless of sexual orientation. But Jean-Yves Dutel, OutGames chief of media relations, says the Montreal event will take that concept further.
What we'll present next year for this first OutGames is to show to non-gay people that first we're part of a society. And we're here to stay. Second, that we don't classify people by being non-gay, gay, white, black, and so on. Okay, when you're gay, you understand very quickly what is intolerance, what is racism, and the old games will also be a festival to show we accept everybody who accepts us.
Today, both sides seem hesitant to delve too far into past troubles, and there's little sign of conflict at the OutGames offices. In fact, there's little sign of anyone, as many of the 18 staffers are out at one event or another, working on outreach and registration.
So, that's the sport department here, if two people also on the road.
Dutel gives an energetic tour of the OutGames offices in Montreal's Olympic Park, former home of the 1976 Olympic Games. The building might be grungy, but housing the OutGames here serves as a powerful symbol of government support for the event. Chatting over coffee in his beautifully appointed backyard in downtown Montreal, OutGames co-president Mark Tewksbury is still sometimes surprised at how much support the event has received.
Sometimes I pinch myself because, thank goodness, we live in a country where we're completely equal in the eyes of the government, and our event is treated like any other major festival or big event, which, as you know, Montreal is really famous for.
Tewksbury freely admits that he didn't enter into this project with a deep knowledge of the history and values of the movement. A three-time Olympic medalist in swimming and former member of the International Olympic Committee, he had never even heard of the Gay Games before he was asked to become co-president of Montreal's bid committee. As much as Tewksbury has embraced the gay sports movement, he sees its success as limited. That's why the Montreal event is called the Out Games, a brand Tewksbury hopes will have more appeal to non-gay athletes. And a new organization called GLISA, the Gay and Lesbian International Sport Association, was formed to offer ongoing support for gay athletes and constant outreach to traditional sports.
If we look forward to 20 years, if we're still isolated, we haven't succeeded. We haven't made any progress. If homophobia is still what it is today, where there are no openly out gay basketball players, football players, hockey players, soccer players in the world. Come on, there's got to be some out there. We haven't really reached our goal. The gay gains movement from a social change perspective hasn't shifted anything yet.
Meanwhile, athletes are beginning to register for the Out Games and the Gay Games, with early reports suggesting that Montreal is attracting more international participation and more Americans are signing up for Chicago. For Outsports.com's Jim Buzinski, that's the saddest part of the split.
One of the great things about the Gay Games has always been this bringing together of the world, so to speak. I mean, the opening ceremonies where you're seeing people from Europe, Africa, Asia, the Middle East, the U.S., it's just so exciting. My concern is that next year you're not going to see that as much because people will have to make a choice, and I think it's really going to hurt what had been the great unifying thing of the games.
Back at the Boston Strikers Sunday practice, Rodney Bird sits on the sidelines taking a break. Bird's been with the team since the beginning, and he's attended every gay games since 1990. As someone involved in the gay sports movement, Bird says he knows more than most about the split between the gay games and the out games. He doesn't exactly join the optimists who see it as a sign that the gay sports movement has grown large enough to support two events. Nor does he join Jim Buzinski in calling the movement dysfunctional.
We're growing, and so I think the gay games served a certain role, and I think as we become more out and open in the world, there's not just one thing that we are all about, and I think having two events, they're competing, and I think maybe in some ways they might take away from each other. But at the same time, I think it's an evolution and probably one that is due.
Rodney Bird plans to march in the opening ceremonies for the 2006 Gay Games on July 15th at Wrigley Field in Chicago. He'll likely be in the stands for the Out Games opening ceremonies 2 weeks later at the Olympic Stadium in Montreal. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
More than 500 speed demons between the ages of 8 and 17 roared onto a track near Denver for last weekend's National Hot Rod Association Junior Drag Racing League Western Conference Finals. There, kids with a penchant for speed beyond what the family minivan can provide competed for prize money and glory. Nancy Greenlease reports.
Well, here we go, round one of competition coming at you now from here at Bannermere Speedway. And this is
AJ Fernandez is hunkered down in a car that looks like a giant aardvark's nose, painted in red and yellow flames. The 4 foot 2 inch, 75 pound California native is preparing to defend his title in the 8 to 9 year old age group as Claire Fernandez, a crew member who also happens to be his mom, fusses.
You want me to throw water at you? Wake you up a little bit?
Nope. He's ready to ride. He knocks a glove fist against his dad's before inching to the starting line. Then the light turns green. AJ reaches a speed of almost 46 miles per hour on Vandermeer's 1/8 mile strip, creaming his competition. His mom leaps into the air.
I can breathe now, because, oh my goodness, the first round is the worst. Once he makes it past the first round, he's all good. He's happy. That's all he cares about.
Junior drag racing requires more than a heavy foot. Organizers use a handicapping system that levels the field for drivers of all abilities. Drivers estimate their time based on prior runs. If they come in under that time, it's grounds for disqualification. If both cars match their selected time, the winner is the one with the quickest reaction time at the start. AJ Fernandez says he can't help going too fast sometimes. After all, the 10-year-old racer used to be a daredevil in diapers.
When I was little, I used to jump off my stroller while it was moving. And I would jump off the swings while I'm going as fast as I can on the swings. I like going fast.
Although cars cost more than your typical stroller, $10,000 on the average, parents of junior drag racers are sold on the sport's benefits. Jaime Fernandez says he wanted to find a sport that would keep his son AJ away from drugs and other troubles.
What better sport than this where the parent has to be involved? Me, I take care of the car and my honey does the other half. And you know what? It works great. You know, the kid, all he does is he just sits back and relaxes.
Today, the Texas Raceway team is a swarming mass of yellow and black. Called the Killer Bees, they hold up letters spelling out their name. Each driver is associated with a raceway team, and they fill the stands to cheer on their fellow racers.
Go, Travis, go! Go, Travis, go!
This is their World Series. It's the Super Bowl.
Eric Lotz is Field Marketing Director for the National Hot Rod Association, or NHRA. The association hopes junior dragsters will develop into pros, weekend warriors, or at least dedicated fans. The NHRA says the number of junior dragsters has increased after years of stagnation. 5,000 kids participate at local tracks, and the elite few make it to this final race, says Lotz.
It's bragging rights for the year. You can win your track championship, you can win even a divisional championship, but if I won the Western Conference Finals, I'm the king.
Or, as the case may be, the queen. Girls ascend to the drag racing throne as often as boys do. After last weekend's first round elimination, Shannon Sullinger of Tulsa hops from her car and pulls off her helmet. Wavy blonde hair flows out, like in a cheesy music video. But this is no act. She's made it through the first round in the 11-year-old age group.
I thought he had me, but I flew right by him, and so it was crazy.
You're out of breath.
Yes, I am.
Does that happen when you race the car?
No, but whenever you win, it does.
While followers of pro motorsports often gush over the rare female driver like Indy standout Danica Patrick, girls make up about a quarter of junior dragsters, which is just fine with Shannon.
It's good that I get to beat the boys. You know, it shows them how it's done. Oh, that's so cool.
But letting a girl or a boy tear down a racetrack at speeds up to 85 miles per hour may seem unsafe. But parents insist that the sport is safer than football. No kids have died since the Junior League started in 1992, and injuries are uncommon. Vehicles must meet the same stringent standards of pro cars, says John Miller, who's in charge of technical operations at this event.
Take like a seatbelt. Every 2 years they have to replace them because we know of over time they just deteriorate to a point where they might not be safe. I have a 5-year-old and 3-year-old. They're not racing yet, but I'd be comfortable to put my kid in one of these because they're probably the safest thing out here.
Back at the starting line, drivers will soon duke it out in the finals. Casey Teeley, a girl from Montana, ends up clinching the victory over Chase Birch in the 8- and 9-year-old category. A.J. Fernandez, the defending champion, is philosophical about the fact that he didn't make it this far.
It happens all the time. I win, and if I lose. It's an everyday schedule.
He was knocked out in the 4th round after going too fast. The loss briefly upset the grizzled 10-year-old veteran.
I actually did cry. Then I got over it, and then I came down to the go-kart track, and I have another try. I can try again.
AJ tears around the track at a nearby go-kart center, dodging hay bales. One loss won't stop this disappointed demon on wheels. For Only a Game, I'm Nancy Greenlease in Morrison, Colorado.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org.
Tearing down the better line is never coming back. Expect us waiting just ahead. Go, Speed Racer! Go, Speed Racer! Go, Speed Racer! Go! Go, Speed Racer! Go, Speed Racer! Go, Speed Racer! Go!
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston. Additional support comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And from the Dairy Farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at Cabot Cheese.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a history of the West 4th Street basketball tournament. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
I want you to take this bat here because I am about to lob you a softball. Are you ready?
Of course.
Okay. After Baltimore Orioles slugger Rafael Palmeiro, who told Congress in March that he had never used steroids, was suspended this week for testing positive for stanozolol, Representative Tom Davis indicated that his House Government Reform Committee was on the case, and he said, here it comes, Charlie, if we did nothing, I think we'd look like idiots, don't you?
Given the governing majority in both houses of Congress, if they did nothing, I'd throw them all a parade.
The Heat's Shaquille O'Neal has taken a pay cut from $30 to $20 million per annum. Do you foresee lower ticket prices in Miami this season?
No, but it gives Miami a little bit more flexibility on its roster than it wouldn't have before. Shaq's agent, Perry Rogers, however, has a side career of writing the dialogue for movie trailers because he was quoted as saying, Shaquille can name his price. And the price he named was winning.
Dun, dun, dun.
This time, it's personal.
The increasingly traveled Antoine Walker was part of the largest trade in NBA history this week. That deal involved five teams and 17 players. Which teams are improving as a result of the rather brisk off-season dealing?
Well, I don't know. I think one of the more interesting ones was Stromile Swift, who's always had more money than sense and more potential than achievement, has gone to Houston, where there's a lot more talent around him, and I think he might just blossom next year. He might be. He's young. He's only been in the league 5 years. He still averaged 9 points and five rebounds for the Grizzlies. He's never played on a really good team. This is a player who could blossom this year.
The National Hockey League is also in the throes of buyout wackiness due to a similar clause in its new collective bargaining agreement. As a result, we're seeing the most thorough makeover in league history. So, will the changing rosters help bring back the fans?
I have two pages of NHL transactions on here, and I recognize about three names. The rest of it sounds like the people who went to prep school with the Brothers Karamazov. I don't know who these folks are.
So it won't bring you back?
Not yet, no. I want to see the game played. I want to see the rule changes, which will help speedy, crowd-pleasing players like, say, Paul Correa. But right now, no, I'm not energized by the return of the NHL simply by the transaction column, no.
Mike Modano is staying in Dallas. Speaking of hockey players, have we seen enough trading to know which teams will be better than they were when they last played before the fabled, fumbled, lost season?
I don't remember. What teams were good? The Stanley Cup's still in Tampa, right?
Well, the Avs were pretty good, and they've lost Forsberg and Adam Foote, so they may not be as good as they were before.
The Avs offered Forsberg, who is no worse than one of the three or four best players in the league, $13.5 million over 4 years, and that was as high as they could go. He was, of course, the greatest prize in the now legendary trade that sent Eric Lindros at one point to two teams in the NHL, but eventually to Philadelphia.
In sports business news, Adidas has acquired Reebok, and the people who accomplished that acquisition immediately announced that the primary objective of the combined companies would be to end world hunger. So, will their shoes be edible forthwith?
No, but I'm dying to go to the first merged Christmas party where I can see what David Beckham will have to say to Jay-Z and Missy Elliott.
They also claimed, by the way, that no jobs would be lost, and I'm sure you can take that to the bank.
And when jobs are lost, I will be shocked. Shocked to learn that they were misleading us.
At 5'3", Muggsy Bogues was always the smallest guy on his NBA team, but starting this week, he's being towered over by women rather than by men. Bogues took over as head coach of the WNBA's 3-21 Charlotte Sting. What coaching qualities does Bogues bring to the sidelines there?
Well, certainly a burst of energy and a little bit of star power at the gate, but I don't think even Muggsy Bogues can turn around a 3-21 WNBA team in less than a season.
His shortest player is a guard who's 5'6".
And she's taller than me. I mean, at the very least, it's going to be one of the great wire photos of our time.
Speaking of short people, jockey Pat Day announced his retirement this week after 32 years in the irons. This is a guy who was elected to the Racing Hall of Fame 15 years ago. Are there any other sports where you can continue to compete for 15 years after you've been immortalized?
Not as a participant, as a coach, of course. Mike Krzyzewski and Jim Calhoun are both in the Basketball Hall of Fame.
And any number of trainers and racehorses.
And no sign of their leaving. But you got to remember, Pat Day, if you do the math, Pat Day is only 51 years old. He's been riding since he was 19. And he has more earnings than any other rider, and I'm going to try to get this total right, although my math skills may be on it. He has made $297,941,912 in his 8,800-some-odd victories. His agent, who, by the way, is a rider's agent named Doc Danner.
Now,
if this isn't horse racing, I don't know what is. He says he's at a plateau in his life where the Lord's calling him off to do other things. Well, he's certainly calling him off the horse anyway.
The NIT tournament is taking court action, in this case, an antitrust lawsuit against the NCAA tournament. Is the charge that the NCAA basketball tournament is too popular? Is that their idea?
No. The charge is the NCAA sees something that he can't get his fingers on and therefore is employing its longtime motto, which translated from the Latin is me some too, yes. But actually, there's more than a little lore to this. In 1969-70, at the end of the 1970 basketball season, Al McGuire of beloved memory and the Marquette Warriors were sent to the NCAA regional in Lubbock, Texas, where he did not want to go. Al said, "What can I get in Lubbock? A couple of cheerleaders and three cows. Screw it. I'm going to the NIT and win that." That is the last time a team was allowed to turn down an NCAA bid.
This week, Susan Polgar, a four-time women's chess champion, played 300 games simultaneously. One of her opponents was 4 years old. Another of them was 95 years old. And Ms. Polgar had to be in pretty good shape for this challenge.
Yeah, playing chess for 18 hours is crucial enough. By Monday afternoon, she was playing 326 games at the same time, which is enough to break the world record of 321 in the Guinness Book of World Records. Of course, if I wanted to break this record and I were a cynical and cheating sort, I would just get 500 people who I know would, like, tip over their king all
roll
at once.
Over.
Ready? Concede!
No,
I win!
But this was interesting because she had to walk 18 miles
That's
from
right.
board to board to board.
18 miles from board to board, exactly. I like the one guy who said he expected to put up a tough fight. He didn't expect to put up a tough fight, but he planned to get through 20 moves.
Not bad. And finally, Charlie, as you know, North Korean propaganda has made many claims regarding the astonishing achievements of the country's dear leader, Kim Jong-il, but I wonder if any of those claims is more remarkable than the assertion of the cherished eminence's prowess as a golfer.
In the first round he ever played, dear leader shot 11 holes in one, and I'm sure there was a security man sitting on every plastic bear, every little wooden windmill, and inside the clown's mouth.
Charlie Pierce, the best golfer in the room right now, writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week at this time. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Basketball is a winter game. Well, except for the Olympics, of course, and the WNBA, and the formal and informal playground leagues that thrive in various cities. So basketball is a game for all seasons, and in his new book, Inside the Cage, subtitled A Season at West 4th Street's Legendary Tournament, White Martindale makes a case for summer as the best time for appreciating basketball in its purest form. White Martindale joins me now from New York. Welcome to Only a Game.
Nice to meet you. Nice to talk with you.
Any discussion of the West 4th Street tournament should probably begin with Kenny Graham, without whom I guess there would be no West 4th Street tournament. Tell me about Kenny Graham.
Kenny Graham is a very accomplished person. There are lots of Kenny Grahams in this world, and they're kind of people that are seldom recognized. He is not a saint. He is a person that hustles for a living. He makes a living. He does not steal from people. He does not borrow money. He does not pay back. He does not fail to show up on time. He is a reliable person, but he's not a person with great connections. He's a limousine driver. He has maintained a tournament for 28 years now that no one, I believe, could have maintained for 28 years. There are very few institutions of any sort that last that long under that kind of direction and that prosper. And this has done very, very well year after year after year. And he's built a kind of a community that I think is admirable. That's why I wrote the book, to point out that there are communities being built in places that people don't really recognize, and they're getting better all the time, and people that they don't think are really big deals are doing it.
Kenny Graham is not the only regular at 4th Street who has cobbled together lots of jobs and various hustles. Might some of the other men who play in the tournament or manage the teams or otherwise help out be a little reluctant to talk about how they survive?
One of the reasons I wrote the book is that no one else could tell the story I felt. I don't mean to be vain, but I don't think anyone has ever had this perspective. I've worked with the tournament for 15 years. Mm-hmm. The tournament is 25 years old. Actually, 20 years, 1985, excuse me. So I know the people. I know how it works. And it's like I'm a kind of a consigliere that is on the inside. I still do I prepared our tax returns this year. I've done that before. I help run the tournament, but I really don't have anything to do with the basketball part of it. Any advice there I would give would either be obvious or wrong. But I do, but I recognize that. But I am involved with it, so it's kind of an insider's view. I'm trying to provide a view of somebody who walks by these places and sees these guys, you know, yelling and hollering and jumping around and playing great basketball, and everybody's all excited and they're shaking the fence, and when the fence shakes, it's like somebody dumped a bucket of nails on concrete. It really makes a racket. And they wonder, who are these guys anyway? And, of course, the point of my book is these guys are very substantial citizens. One of the great untruths that America keeps swallowing is that the myth of the inner-city athlete who can jump to the sky but is socially dysfunctional. They love to write about Allen Iverson. They love to write about screw-ups. But my point is that most of these guys, and Kenny Graham and the people who come to this tournament are good representatives, aren't that at all. They have, excuse the expression, actual middle-class values. Mm-hmm. They go home at night. Mm-hmm. They want to take care of their kids. Most of the people at West 4th Street are in their 30s. They've had their day in the sun, and they're playing because they love the game. They still play a very competitive game and a very rough game.
Well, that was going to be the next thing that I wanted to get to. This tournament has gained a reputation as a great place to see an enormous variety of players. What's the age range, the skills range, the background range on a given day at West 4th Street?
If you went there today, you might not see anyone who's played in the NBA. You would see people who have played overseas professionally, and almost everyone has played in college. That's the level of play. You would see some young kids, but not a whole lot of young kids. There's a team called the Youngsters that has traditionally brought kids out of high school or in college that have played there. You would mostly see, I would say, guys from 20 to 35 playing, and with the emphasis on older players. Lambert Schell is a person I like to point out. He is probably 40 pounds overweight. He played for Bridgeport. His jersey hangs in the Springfield Hall of Fame of basketball because he got 3,000 points and 2,000 rebounds in 3 years at Bridgeport. I mean, he's a sensational player. He's a little out of shape. He knows it. He's been there, done that. He's played overseas. He plays in the park because he has fun. He likes the people. He likes to bang guys. He likes to shoot. It's a nice place to play.
The West 4th Street Tournament shares lots of characteristics with other summer leagues that people will have heard of. Most of the players have earned nicknames, volunteers are essential in all cases, and the sneaker companies are involved as sponsors. But what are some of the characteristics that distinguish this particular tournament from, say, the Rucker Tournament or some of the others?
I was at Rucker last night, so I can tell you, although I go every year and I'm familiar with it, but I don't go there as often as I go to West 4th Street. I go to all the tournaments, actually, to see what's going on. What distinguishes West 4th Street is its lack of certain things. That is, it lacks a public address system, an electronic system. They have a bullhorn that they announce, you know, who's scoring and whatnot. They lack an electric scoreboard. Instead, you have a character that called Moneybags, who stands there with a piece of chalk, a tiny blackboard, and he writes the score after every basket, and that is our scoreboard. And we call an electronic scoreboard, but it's not, and we call him Moneybags, and he never has any money. We do not have music. Kenny feels it would very much offend the neighborhood, and so there's no music, on timeouts or things like that. What it is a basketball game. We try to play basketball for people who like basketball. That's the idea, and I think that distinguishes it. Its absence of showbiz, its absence of big sponsors. We have fewer. We have one sponsor this year. Total one. One. I mean, Rucker must have seven. They must have seven record companies. Recording companies. Forget the fact they have Reebok and, you know, serious companies like that. What we do have is Nike. And Nike is number one in this game. And when Nike sponsors a tournament, they do it right. And so we're, you know, we get through every year. And our, you know, teams look good and it's organized.
You note that the West 4th Street tournament has changed over the years. And some of the changes veterans of the tournament discuss in your book, they don't consider especially positive. Kenny Graham himself seems likely to be spending more and more time in Rio rather than New York. How bright is the future of the tournament?
I think it is a very touchy issue. I don't think it's locked up. I'm not saying don't worry, we're going to go for another 50 years just like we are. I think every institution has to fight for its life. I think we have to struggle to get good players. I think we have to struggle to keep the game clean and straight and competitive. I think any good institution has to keep working at it. Basketball has proliferated terrifically so that the competition for tournaments is all over the place now. West 4th Street's place in the community, which is what I'm most concerned with, is going to remain. But it has to remain a viable social function. That is, the game has to be good enough to draw the people. You have to draw the right kind of people. We're still drawing the right kind of people. Kenny is suffering from, and I guess I could say I am too, a loss of our first generation. We're looking at kids now. Kenny used to run boat trips because they were his friends playing basketball. Most of the good players are 20 years younger than he is now. That's different. And sustaining that is, I think, one of his great achievements. It's hard to do. But, I think you have to have things like this for society to function well. And this one is doing it. And, you know, if it only lasts for 30 years, it wasn't a bad run. Thank you very much.
White Martindale is the author of Inside the Cage, subtitled A Season at West 4th Street's Legendary Tournament. Mr. Martindale is also a managing director of the tournament. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. Mr. Martindale, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you for your time.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from all the fine folks at Splash Studios in New York. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to browse Only a Game show archive or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from White Martindale Jr., author of Inside the Cage. I asked him if he was related to legendary TV game show host Wink Martindale.
Don't I wish. I wouldn't be working for a living.
I don't know. It's been decades since High Rollers and Tic-Tac-Toe. Maybe Wink could use some of your West 4th Street cabbage. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, from NPR member stations, from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from Vision to Innovative Impact, 75 years of philanthropy, on the web at wkkf.org, and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.